Welcome to the MedTech Talent Lab, the number one catalyst for advancing careers and building high-performance teams. Sponsored by the Anthony Michael Group, helping companies secure in-demand talent in regulatory affairs, quality, clinical, engineering, R&D, and other areas for medical device, digital health, diagnostics, and other organizations across the U.S. life sciences sector. Here's your host, Mitch Robbins.
All right, welcome back to another episode here on the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. It's Mitch Robbins, your host. Today, I have the pleasure of hosting Mr. Mike Winterling, who is the Chief Operating Officer at Juncosha USA. So Mike, with his bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering and his MBA, he spent almost 30 years working for W.L. Gore and Associates. Yes, 30 years. He worked across positions in engineering, operations, and product before joining Juncosha in 2020. And today, he serves as the company's Chief Operating Officer. Now, if you aren't familiar, Juncosha supplies a wide range of products like wires, cables, tubing, connectors, injection moldings, to many of the world's finest organizations across several different industries like food and beverage, healthcare, medical technology, robotics, construction, and others. And it is a sincere pleasure to welcome you to the show, Mike. How are you?
Hey, good, Mitch. Thanks for having me on. Yeah. Looking forward to this today.
I am too. I'm thrilled because you bring a different vantage point to the show than we've had in a while, which is, man, you spent almost three decades at a very large organization that many of us in the industry obviously know of and kind of know what's going on. And then you made this pretty significant change where you came to a much smaller organization with the opportunity to kind of scale up. And we're going to dig into all that today, which I'm very excited to do. But to talk about kind of present day, we've got to go way back in time first. I'd love for you to tell us more about your formative years. What did you grow up? Where did you grow up? What was your family life like? Things like that.
Yeah, so I grew up in Maryland. I was born in Baltimore, went to high school near Columbia, Maryland. And, dad was in sales. My mom was a nurse. So both parents working. And, when it came time to college, I went to Lehigh up in Bethlehem. And one of my family members, my uncle, had worked for this crazy company called W.L. Gore & Associates. And he'd tell us stories about, there's no titles and, no bosses. There's this very strange organization. He loved it. And I ended up getting an internship there between my junior and senior years, and then continued on from Christmas through. They hired me, and so started right out of college at Gore doing an engineering role.
So I want to ask you, though, real quick, if you go back, a couple things. Do you have siblings?
I have a younger brother. Okay. And, I think growing up, I was into sports, into music. So did a little bit of everything through high school and played tennis a little bit in college and, got involved with sports a lot after college as well.
Wow, you must be one heck of a tennis player if you were playing in college.
Well, I was more the number one bench warmer than the star of the team, Mitch. So
that's better than a lot of us can say. That's awesome. And then, I mentioned that you had your bachelor's in mechanical engineering. Were you interested in tinkering around with things as a kid, or were you interested in science as a kid? How'd you end up going that direction?
My dad was a carpenter's apprentice before he got involved in the sales and in the engineering side. So he always had us working on things growing up. We did a lot of things on our own, repaired cars, all that kind of stuff. So I was really interested in taking things apart and fixing things. And it just, loved science through high school. It was pretty clear to me that's what I wanted to do going into college.
That's awesome. And then it makes sense about your transition to W.L. Gore. Now let's get into some of the meat of what we're really focusing on today, which is the huge transition that you've made and kind of what it's like on the other side, so to speak, and kind of going forward from here.
Right.
I want to say, whatever reason it may have been at the time, you needed to make a change. You needed to make a change, and you could have done a lot of different things. Could have gone and worked for a strategic could have done a lot of different things. How did you end up deciding to make this move and have such a drastic change in your career?
Yeah, that's a good question. For the longest time, I expected I was going to be retiring at Gore. So it wasn't something that I was necessarily, intending to do. There have been opportunities that had come up over the years. A good friend of mine had been in recruiting and kind of told me, hey, there's this magic time point. If you hit 50 and you haven't made a career change, you're probably not going to do it. And so I just happened to be, I was turning 50 and I had heard about Junkosha from my time at Gore. There was a relationship between Junkosha and Gore, but also a colleague who I'd stayed in touch with and worked with several times at Gore, who probably was the best leader I'd worked with during my time there. He had left and was working with Junkosha, so we had stayed in touch, and there was always the he would kind of say, "Hey, someday we're going to work together again," and I'm like, "Yeah." And then in 2020, I don't know if it was the COVID thing, turning 50, whatever else was going on in the world, it all of a sudden became the right time to make the change.
That's great. And do you remember, so you mentioned you had a friend there. Did, during that interview process, did anybody challenge you? Like, hey, man, you're used to having a lot of support. I know, because if I remember correctly, you came in as a VP of business development before.
I did.
Becoming the COO. Did anybody challenge the idea of the fact that you're used to having a lot of structure, a lot of infrastructure, a lot of support versus perhaps what you were going to have here? Did that come up?
I guess, it didn't really come up, and it wasn't something I was worried about, in part because I think in my time at Gore, I ended up working in a lot of different jobs in different divisions and in different locations. So spent some time overseas in Hong Kong as well. And you just sort of develop a self-sufficiency to be able to go figure out how to get things done. And that's definitely one of the aspects of a small team. I think there were seven of us when I joined Junkosha USA. It's, there's no one there to do that. There's no IT department, so there are times where I'm Cyber Mike and I have to go figure things out. It's definitely it's a challenge. It's exhilarating and it's frustrating all at the same time when you switch from that large organization to the small one.
What do you think it's not for to make that change?
I mean, you have to be self-driven and, be able to prioritize on your own and figure out what you work on and what you don't. So if you like a lot of structure and you just want I want my lane, I want to be doing this one job, it's not the place for you. There a lot of things come up. Customers ask us for things all the time. Well, no, we've never been asked that, and someone's got to go figure out. And guess what? That someone's probably you. So that's pretty much anyone in a small team like this has to be flexible enough to do what you need to do to get the job done and keep the customer happy.
Mm-hmm. Are there any? So it probably goes without saying that, when you were leaving Gore and you were coming here, you realized a lot of that ahead of time. Like, look, it's much smaller. I'm sure we're going to have less resources. We're going to have to rely on, I'm going to have to rely on myself to do a lot more than I'm used, perhaps used to. I don't want to assume wrongly, but let's just say the common sense piece is out of the way. Smaller team, less resources. Is there anything, what was unexpected that you weren't necessarily anticipating when you came on?
What wasn't? So I guess mentally you prepare yourself for some of those changes, but then when you're actually in the middle of it, I guess the first time you go swimming and you don't have the swimmies on, there's this, anxiety. Are you going to be able to do it? Is it going to work out? I think it takes a little bit of time to get used to not having the support, not having the structure, being in a small team, being in a remote team. So one of the other big differences, Gore, for my whole career, was you go to an office somewhere and you're with people all the time. And there's a lot of spontaneity that happens in that type of environment. And when you go to mostly a virtual environment, it's a very different working environment. You have to figure out how to make those connections that would happen at the water cooler or the coffee pot and do that in a different way. So I think that's a big one. I think another one is just, when I started out, it was during COVID. I live in an old farmhouse, and you can kind of see around me here. And at the time I had DSL internet, I was barely able to have, we couldn't have this kind of conversation, in 2020. There's no way. So, now I have Starlink and it's much better here than it was then. But, you just have to figure out ways to make things work. And you probably each day becomes it's hard to plan exactly what you're going to be doing because it depends, what kind of comes in and becomes a priority that day.
I love the analogy you gave about swimming for the first time without the floaties. It makes so much sense where it's like you have some confidence. It's like, okay, a little bit, I guess, at that point. But then there's so much anxiety about the what ifs and how's this going to feel and what to expect. That makes so much sense. It's a really good one.
I think when you've been in a company that long and you kind of see that as you're connected to it, it's a part of you. You've sort of grown up with that. You don't expect to leave it. It's hard leaving it. Probably the same way when you leave home the first time, just to have the confidence go out and do something different. So, I think that's short lived. I mean, you make the change, you get into it, and it doesn't take that long until you're, fully involved with what's next. So, people are in that kind of situation. They're afraid to make that leap and make the change. It's really probably a positive thing. You're going to grow in ways that you were probably denying yourself, by staying in some situations.
As they say, growth is just outside our comfort zone, right?
Right. Exactly.
So when you came, there were 8 employees. Is that right?
I think I was number 7.
You were number 7.
Yeah.
At that point, 1 employee, 2 employees makes a huge impact. And the cost of mishire, we talk about both direct costs and indirect costs of a mishire, but in a smaller company like that, where it's that critical, it's huge. Talk a little bit about that. Cause how many employees are you today?
Today we're at 20.
Okay. I mean, that's a big deal. Been 4 years. So talk, if you would, about your thoughts around getting it right when you've got, as few employees as you guys did then and how every hire does count.
It means everything. If you have a small team like that and you have one person who's, I don't know the word, not pulling your weight or just creating conflict within the team, that's just hugely destructive to the team. I guess there's a second piece of it. It's a small team, but it's also a newly formed team. So it was 7 in 2020. Now we're up to 20. Over half of those people have about a year with us, a year or a year and a half at the most. So we're trying to create a culture for this U.S. part of our organization. We have we're part of a 70 plus year old company, based in Japan, but the sales and marketing in the U.S. and Europe is very new. So we're trying to create our own culture that is, aligned with the culture in Japan, but that works in the U.S. and Europe. Because, there are, as much as you want it to be the same, there are going to be cultural differences, between the Japan team and what we're doing here.
Yeah. What would you say? That's great segue, actually. What would you say are the primary differences as far as trying to work in an international business environment?
Yeah, this is funny coming from me, but typically when people are hired in Japan, you're joining the company for life. So there's a two-way commitment. The company's making commitment to the employee that we're going to, work with you for the rest of your life. So it's a big deal to hire someone. And there's a lot of work that goes into finding the right role. So people, when they're hired, tend to move around, try different things, get good at different things, and then, ultimately find more of a home in one area or another. So I think that's a big difference. I think there's definitely a culture of trust and respect. There's a lot of team decision making. So I'm trying to think of what other, some of the bigger differences are. I think those are probably some of the bigger ones, Mitch.
Yeah, I couldn't help, but I didn't know that about the culture there. And I couldn't help but think about the movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's an animated movie with Jerry Seinfeld as one of the voices. It's called, I think it's called B. And the whole premise was that as a bee, like you grow up and the thing, you go to the factory, right? And the thing kind of spits out what is your job for the rest of your life. Like, are you the one that goes out of the hive and get, you know, are you the one that does? So that's kind of what it reminds me of. That's really interesting. So is that, you're saying that's the Japanese culture or that's, wow.
So I think it is. I think it's changed a bit over the years in terms of like broader Japanese culture. I think there is a bit more specialization now in people that get, they either train in college or they you know, have a certain role that they're hired into. I think there's still, you know, our company definitely has a lot of that mentality. So we're hiring people, we're bringing them in for life. We still have a lot of the programs to move people around. So I think that tends to be true. I'm sure there are lots of exceptions, and we have people we've hired in with expertise in certain areas. But you do, overall, I think you have a company with a lot more generalists and not as many really in-depth. That's, you know, again, this is a generalization, but
yeah,
it's a difference that I see between, you know, when we hire, we tend to hire for a specific role or function. You know, our team, we're focused on sales and marketing for US and Europe. So I'm looking for a particular skill set, not necessarily that broad generalist skill set.
Which is interesting, because if you look at your career, you were in engineering, you were in operations, you were in product, you came in and did a business development role, and now you're an executive, you know, leading as a COO. What's your take on it in general as far as somebody who's got broad a base of knowledge versus a really finite skill set who's very, very deep and specialized? And how does that apply as far as your outlook as far as somebody being able to kind of rise up as well in the organization?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I mean, my career was pretty unusual at Gore in the sense that, you know, I moved around and worked in four different divisions while I was there. I was able to change roles. So I went back and got a master's in business part-time while I was still, you know, doing my day job. And but with the idea of moving more into a business role longer term, I saw that as a skill set that wasn't as common at Gore. There were a lot of technical people, not as many trained more in business. So that was something I chose to do. There's, you know, I was at Gore 30 years, but I did make a lot of changes. And every time you make one of those changes, there's a lot of risk involved. You're moving to a new team. In a way, at Gore, the way compensation works, you're starting almost at the bottom of the list and have to work your way up that list again. In terms of, we could probably have a whole episode on Gore philosophy around contribution and compensation. But so it's, I think for me personally, I enjoyed the challenge of learning a new role, a new business, a new opportunity. And I think, you know, that leads to this breadth of understanding, and it comes in handy for me in this role today, because I can work with the sales team, I can work with the technical teams, whatever we need to do to support the business. But I'll tell you, there's a huge amount of value in, you know, people with really deep expertise in certain areas. And, you know, I know where my weaknesses are, and I rely heavily on people who are experts in certain areas to make sure that we're making the right decisions.
Do you think it makes you a better leader, given the fact that you have such a broad background?
It definitely helps, because I think one of the biggest challenges is when you don't know what you don't know, and you get into something and you maybe get out over your head a little, and you know, knowing enough to be dangerous allows you to, you know, at least pause and make sure you're bringing in the right people and the right expertise early on when you know you need it. So it definitely helps with, you know, having that broader sense, that broader perspective of the needs and making sure you're covering all the bases with the business and the team.
Let me ask you this. You know, I mentioned kind of, we talked through, you know, your formative years and growing up and kind of your interests and how you got to Gore. Did you know, though, that coming into your career that one day, hey, I want to be an executive and be helping to run a company, or not necessarily?
Not necessarily. I think, so certainly I was interested in getting into engineering and wanted to build things and fix things. And, you know, so, but I didn't know, was I going to be doing product development, machine design? Like, I really didn't. I would say, you know, as a student, I don't know that I was exposed to really what all the options were. So if you were to ask me what does a process engineer do, or what do different types of companies or business do, when I was in college, I had no clue. I think high schools do a bit better job today. I think my kids have a better idea of what's out there, but you still, when you're young, you don't really know. You do see people that really have that idea from early on that you know, I'm going to lead a business, or I'm going to run a company, or I'm going to do, and I think that's great. Having that direction, you know, makes it easier to set goals and other things in a way. I guess for a lot of my career, it was shorter term horizons that I was really focused on. You know, there were the things you're working on today and maybe a 5-year view, but not trying to think too far ahead.
Mm-hmm. Was your first formal management role, your formal leadership role, was it in engineering or in operations?
It was in operations.
Okay. And what was that transition like? Because I think that's probably one of the hardest moves to make, is being a very good individual contributor to now all of a sudden being responsible for other people, because the skill set's different.
Yeah. I think, I guess the biggest change that happens is you go from being just focused on your individual contributions, or even, you know, I led small teams, making sure that the priorities were clear and people knew what they needed to do. But the biggest change is when you switch to leading others, just you're focused on coaching and developing and helping the individuals and the team get stronger, as opposed to trying to do things yourself. I think when you first make that move, the easy thing to do is just to do a lot of things yourself rather than, having the team do it, because it feels like it's harder to explain to someone else or to coach or mentor them. I could just be done this if I just take care of it myself. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges to moving into that type of role, is avoiding that temptation just to try to do everything yourself.
It's probably one of the classic pieces of friction for newer managers. What advice do you have for that? Because it is, going back to that analogy with the floaties, where it is anxiety provoking when you know your skill set, but you're having to trust others.
I think there's the, giving people enough rope and latitude to fail, that you accept that it's not going to be perfect. It's not going to be exactly the way you would probably do it. That there are a lot of ways to get things done, and just make sure that it's not going to sink the ship, if gets too far off the rails. So it's just be comfortable that you can coach it and kind of help it get where it needs to go without being really prescriptive for exactly how it needs to get done. Mm-hmm. Takes a little bit of getting used to, I think.
And I always like to ask this, so you get into middle management, you do a good job, you find your way up. One day, a lot of the folks who listen will become executives as well. What were the primary differences you've noticed between middle management and being an executive in the company?
Yeah, it's a good question. I worked at a company where, there aren't a lot of titles and roles. So I'm trying to really think, middle management would have crossed over to what other people might think of as middle management, because you often don't have direct reports in the same way, even though you're leading teams. So it's a very different type of culture. I think, from changing from Gore, to Junkosha, certainly it's about, again, setting the direction, make sure there's a clear plan, making sure you have the right people and the right organization. Once you've, decided these are the goals and this is what we need to go do, getting that right organization that can help to deliver on that. So you tend to think about different things, and then, in this case where we don't have other functions to really support us, sometimes you get in the weeds of, have we registered our business correctly? Or, a lot of other things that I wouldn't really have thought I'd be paying attention to. I thought I was being brought in to, help develop a good business plan. How do we leverage our technology to do more in these markets? And it's, like, are we paying tax correctly in California? Like, for getting
it really indeed. Yeah, and you're in an interesting spot because I'm sure you had pretty good size responsibility at Gore, and you've got similar responsibility from a deliverability standpoint, but now also not as many people, and you're worrying about umpteen different things. So it truly is almost like, even though the company is itself from overseas is not a startup, you're really operating a startup division at least.
Yep, that's true.
If you look across the scope of your leadership experience, what's the toughest decisions you've ever had to make?
I mean, I'd say they fall into a couple different buckets. There had been projects that I was working on that I was convinced were going to be some of the best new projects, but just ran into a technology hurdle or some other hurdle where it just became clear it wasn't going to go. And the sooner you can make that call, the sooner you can get working on the next thing, you know. So sometimes it's really hard when you have a passionate team and people see the potential in something, and just to say, you know, it's just not going to get there, whether it's market, technology, you name it, that can be tough. I think the other thing is, you know, when you're developing people on a team, you know, if there's a really poor performer, it's easy, you know, it's clear it's not working out and you're going to be parting ways. But I think sometimes there are people that are just sort of stuck in, you know, they're kind of doing okay, but you know, it's not what their potential is. And, you just see that there's a misfit between what it is that you're doing and their capabilities and skills and what really excites them. And it's hard sometimes, but it's just clear it's not the right fit to keep going. Mm-hmm. Those are a bit harder where there's not the clear, obvious performance problem or something else. You know, if someone steals from a company, that's easy. It's really hard when, it's what's best for the person and for the company, but it's not a must move, but you know, it's good for everyone involved. That makes sense.
Yeah. How do you ultimately come to that decision to pull the trigger?
I think growing up at Gore, I have a lot of the sponsor mentality where you're working with people and your goal is not to be their boss. It's to help them succeed. And, it's important to give direct feedback. You know, when you see things like that, hey, I know you're not doing what you could be doing. How do we get there? And when you've worked on that for long enough and you realize it's just not getting there, you need to work with the person and make the call and then help them to figure out what's next. But I think once you've gone through it a little bit, and again, it's that mentality of caring about people and trying to really help them succeed. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always feel like it when you're like, hey, I think the best thing is that, you know, you're not going to continue to work here, but let's go find something else, because I think you can really thrive and succeed there. And then, you know, I've had people come back and say, you know what, that was the best thing. I needed that little kick. I'm in another place. I'm much happier now. I didn't know it. And so that, again, when you get that feedback later, it's not going to be right away. It's probably not 6 months. It might be 2 years later, but that helps, you know, when you're sensing that and you're feeling that that's probably the right thing to do.
Yeah, and it's such a delicate balance, because I think that if you keep the eye on what is best for the business, you have to make a call that is best for the business, because that's your job. And right. Then you have people's emotions and people's livelihoods at stake that are sometimes in direct conflict with what's right for the business. And so I appreciate your approach of what you're saying, like, hey, if these people are talented or they're good, but it's just not the right fit, you obviously show some human character here and try to help them to the best of your ability. The reason I say it's a delicate balance is you hear all these stories where people are fired over the, you know, teams meeting, or they get an all hands meeting and they say, hey, today's your last day, and no interaction with their boss, just horrible stuff, or right before the holidays. Like, it's a hard thing in general to run a company. It just is.
Yep. Yeah. I really hope we never have to get in a situation where, you know, we've got to cut serious headcount. And, you know, it's much more fun being on the growth side of things, but, you know, I, I've had to do it. I mean, my first experience, the operations role, was in 2000 to 2002. And we went through a major downturn in a business where some of our key customers went out of business. And all of a sudden, you know, we were on a path to, 60, 80 million, and we were down to 15. And we had to make a big move and move a lot of people from our team. Luckily, most were able to get jobs in other parts of Gore, but it's really hard when you have to go through and help people find other things and let them know, hey, you know, it's not. But at least that one was one where we had opportunities to keep people and not, you know, hey, we have to say goodbye.
Right. Which is the best thing. Yeah. What is it? Good to Great. I think the book is say, get the right people on the bus and then you'll figure out a seat for them. So in that case,
that's right.
That makes a lot of sense. You and I were talking offline just briefly about sales and customer service and kind of how do you serve the customer with the idea of at every touch point, we should be adding some sort of value. Even if it's not a sale right now, we should be adding value.
Yeah.
And we were talking, and I want to talk about this on the show here, because that's another fine line where you're hiring salespeople and their job is to drive business, but you're also encouraging them to add value where they can, even if it doesn't necessarily lead to immediate business. How do you build that into the culture to where there's accountability and there's performance expectations, but there's also the right type of culture that is thriving that you're ideally trying to build, which is that you serve your customers?
Yeah, I think this is where we're really trying to bring in some of the Japanese culture with how we want to mold and build our business. So some of our values around developing long-term partnerships, about product leadership. And so we really want to be a partner for our customers. You know, we want to, if they have a problem, we want them to come to us and we'll do our best to help solve it. If someone brings us something that it's not, you know, we don't have the right technology, we don't have the right products, we'll direct them to other companies that can help solve it. So, but then there's other times where we're able to, you know, hey, we've been using this product and we're able to go back and troubleshoot it, you know, make an engineering change and all of a sudden yields come back online and you know, it becomes a really positive relationship. It means though that you can't have, when you're thinking about the metrics for your sales team, it can't be a complete focus on delivering the dollar, or it can't be a simple focus on how many sales calls you're making today, because you're not going to build strong relationships just by cold calling hundreds of people out there. And the types of customers that we have, especially in the medical space, they don't want that. So it's a different mentality. It means rewarding people a little differently. So we're looking at people's overall contribution. So it's not just the individual. I mean, it's definitely important how they're working to grow and develop the funnels in their territory, that they're building the customer base, that they're making the right contacts to give us opportunities for future projects. That's what we want. But there's also teamwork aspect. So, you know, we've intentionally built a team with people with different expertise. So when someone runs into a challenge, they've got people they can look to. Hey, have you seen this before? Hey, you were in this industry. Can that help me move forward? So it's about building a team that works together to solve the problems and share experiences, build that depth of knowledge in the areas that we're working in. So it's contributing in a little bit different ways than just the focus on the pure revenue aspect.
I gotta touch on that a little bit.
Like,
say that again.
It can be hard though, because when you've hired someone who's been in that role, it's all about meeting a number. And we've had a couple times to say, okay, I understand you want this to get done now, but let's back off. Let's do this as a team. Let's do this in the right way rather than, you know, maybe the way you're thinking about trying to move this forward. We might be ruffling a lot of feathers and or over committing to a customer. Like we want to make sure when we say something, we're going to deliver. So don't overpromise if it's not something we can do. We want to be that trusted partner in the long haul. So there's definitely a adjustment period for some people.
Adjustment period there, but man, there's so much here, because one thing that comes to mind is, how are you baking this into the interview process to ensure that you've got you know, because killers want to deliver. They want to deliver on their number. They are motivated by that. They want to be compensated by that. And then there's farmers who, wonderful account managers, really good at relationships, don't expect them to go and break into new accounts like the killer's going to do. And then there's probably a hybrid somewhere along the way, you know, somewhere as you're describing.
Yeah.
So I guess number one, are you baking that into your interview process somehow, like trying to really be clear about what the culture is that you're building and how you want to do business and trying to ask some questions around that?
It is. So we're definitely testing the team aspect of it. Because if you can't work well as a team, it's not going to work here. You know, we're partnering both here as well as overseas. So you have to be able to communicate across a culture. You have to be sensitive to differences in the culture and how you might phrase and word something. So the interpersonal skills and that sort of intelligence is as important as, you know, that killer instinct to go break into the account and not take no for an answer and go find the right people and build a business. You need to try to find those hybrids, but it's not always easy.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know, you never know from, you know, a few half an hour long interviews, how it's really going to pan out. But you do your best to try to probe that as well as you can.
The other piece I want to ask you about is I literally had this conversation this morning about how you can be best friends with the marketplace, but if you're not bringing in business, like that's well and good. You got good relationships, but you don't have business that A, grows your own business, B, supports your own family, right? So when you talk about a reward system, like, hey, we're really trying to look at how do people get recognized or compensated, it's not just about the actual dollar piece. How are you riding that line? Because it doesn't sound like it's very good on the extremes of that spectrum. It's got to be somewhere as a happy medium.
Yeah, my guess is, because I don't know for sure, but my guess is we probably have a larger base salary and less of a variable or bonus type of salary with what we're going after, because we're not doing things on a commission. We intentionally don't want that type of behavior with how we're working with our customers. So that's probably one difference. And again, it's a bit of finding the right people with the right skill set. And, you know, ideally it's in the industry. Like it's much easier for us to bring someone in who has some open doors to help move things along quicker.
Yeah.
But it's got to be the right person. You need both.
You're speaking my language, Mike. You're speaking my language. I understand. I really, really appreciate what you've shared today. And you've had a really amazing and interesting career. I give you a lot of credit for taking that leap as far as going to way less infrastructure and kind of seeing the bigger vision and being excited about what you can build there. What is next for Gencosha?
Yeah, it's kind of an exciting time. So I don't know if you know what really happened in the last few years in the supply side, especially with extrusions, but lead times went up over a year in a lot of cases for PTFE liners and other components. So we've broken ground on a new, a huge expansion for our medical plant. We've been investing a lot in new capacity, new equipment, so that we won't get in that situation again. So a lot of that's coming online. There's a lot of work on our end to, bring in new technologies and new, new products into the market. So that's, some of those are coming through the pipeline and we're going to be excited to see them, coming out in the not too distant future. There's a lot of, what I would call foundation building that we're doing right now. So updating systems and making sure that we've got the right tools and infrastructure that we're ready to grow in a bigger way. So how do we go from 20 people to, 40 people to, beyond? Making sure we're taking the right steps that we can grow and scale without having it be too painful. So I think those are some big things. Continuing to build a culture. It's still relatively new to having this type of team. And so a lot of work going on with our partners in Japan. How do we work together in a bigger way as one global team to move things forward in a really positive way and build that, a more robust international business So I think that's a big thing. And then I think the other one for us is just being better at communicating the work we're doing around sustainability. So this is something that we take very seriously in Japan. And, you know, obviously a lot of our global partners do as well, but we haven't necessarily communicated it well. A lot of these things in Japan are done verbally, and, you know, we need to be able to document and share so that as we're working with new partners and growing our business, people understand who we're about and or what we're about, and, you know, are comfortable building a relationship with us. So that, I think those are the big things, Mitch. It's definitely a lot of fun and a lot of challenges in there with the growth and the building the team. But it's really rewarding.
I was going to say, definitely something to get you up out of bed in the morning, which is awesome. And a lot of exciting stuff to come, it seems.
Yeah, that's never the issue. The issue is more getting off the phone at night.
We've got that too. You
know, one of the other downsides of the international business is a lot of evening calls, but.
Yep. Listen, I'm thrilled that you decided to join me here. If it's cool with you, what we'll do, like we do with all our shows, is we'll put a link to your LinkedIn profile as well as a link to Genkosha's website. And then anyone who's interested in perhaps learning more, either as a prospective customer or as a prospective employee, we'll encourage them to reach out to you.
That sounds great, Mitch.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for being here, Mike. Mike Winterling, the Chief Operating Officer at Genkosha USA.
Thanks, Mitch. It was a lot of fun. Appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for listening to the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. For more content-rich episodes, log on to theanthonymichaelgroup.com or subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform.